The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Thursday, the 5th of December, 2019. On the podcast today, Chris Bailey, founder of FinancialOrbit.com, covers the following companies. They have news out today: DS Smith, Dunelm, Metro Bank, and Amigo. Also on the podcast, Glenn Goodman, who is a former ITV News business correspondent and now the author of Crypto Trader, covers this week's news from Bitcoin, blockchain, and cryptocurrency world. And, as always, don't forget, I have two lists after the interviews. These lists are the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours and the top five most liked RNSs. By the way, don't forget, you can see top 10 versions of both these lists, and they're quite important lists, you know. They're hot stocks, pretty much, and on the most followed list, if you see a stock there and the share price hasn't risen recently, but people are following it, it's worth doing some research on, you know, because that's where people are following, the money flow, all that kind of stuff. And also, as far as the top five most liked RNS is concerned, then if you do receive an RNS, you know, via the app, from the App Store, free to download, free. What's free these days? Free. Oh, the amount of money's gone into this app, unbelievable. And, you know, it's free. Download it for free, doesn't cost you anything. And if you get an RNS, you know, from the from a platform, and you like the content of that RNS, then don't forget to hit that thumbs up icon. What this will do is it will maybe get it on this most liked list, which on the front page of Vox Markets, which is very visited, a highly visited site. And also, if it's in top five, it'll get on the podcast. And that way, that news will be shared in some way, you see? So it all helps. Don't forget all that. You can see those lists, by the way, at voxmarkets.co.uk.
Tired of using different sites to research companies? Vox Markets aggregates key financial details, pricing data, and company news into one place. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now, it's Chris Bailey, founder of FinancialOrbit.com. You all right, Chris?
Yeah, very good. Thank you, Fred. Good. Very good.
I was just laughing there because you, last night, or this morning, actually, you mentioned something about Joe Swinson being introduced, given the yes. Andrew Neil treatment. And I've not yes. been a fan of Joe Swinson. She wasn't very well known, but Andrew Neil came up with one of the first questions he asked, which is something I thought about recently, and that's the more people get to know her, the less they like her. And he basically gave her that question straight away. But you tweeted that out. And but do you know what? Last night, she didn't do as bad as I thought. I think she did better than Corbyn yeah. did. And I yes. sort of warmed to her a little bit. Maybe I couldn't get any colder towards her, maybe. But I warmed to her a little bit, you know. And one of the funny things she said was about Labour. She said, oh, who knows what Labour want? You know, Jeremy Corbyn's giving a pony to everyone. And I thought, yeah, it is. Corbyn is promising the earth. And that off the cuff, like she's giving a pony to everyone, is quite nice. And now I've seen, you know, Chequers, the old country retreat for prime ministers. He's going to give that to the homeless. And I thought, he's trying to give away everything, isn't he? He's giving away everything.
Well, given he either seems to want to nationalise it or give it away, which is a funny state of affairs, really. But yeah. There you go. I think Jo Swinson actually is. I think she's actually okay. I mean, I would agree that she actually did quite a good job on that interview, and at least she turned up, whilst of course others haven't, or when they've rocked up have bogged it up, really. So good on her for turning up. However, let's face it, delusions of grandeur from a few weeks ago from even suggesting the Lib Dems might be rocking up into 10 Downing Street or whatever, that just isn't going to happen. I think we're on pretty safe ground to say that.
Yeah, absolutely. And do you know what I thought was telling, and you know, from the world that sort of we spend a lot of time in looking at sort of balance sheets and all that stuff and companies and debt and all that. And I was completely astonished how Jeremy Corbyn didn't know what the government bonds were, or, you know, he just basically, you know, has this thought about nationalising companies. And when asked about it, he said, no, we'll just swap shares, government bonds for shares. And Andrew Neil rightly said, well, you're increasing the balance sheet there. You're borrowing, aren't you? No. Government bonds. He said, no, we're not borrowing. He said, no, we're not. He said, we're not borrowing. We're going to swap government bonds for shares. And I thought, what are you talking about? Where do you think government bonds come from? Are they magic money? And I just couldn't get over the man, you know, the leader of the Labour Party, a leader of the opposition. You know, there's a chance he could get in. Of course, the polls are not showing that at the moment, but there is a chance. I mean, the next favourite after the Conservatives. And he knows nothing about one of the biggest policies, which is nationalising companies, which a lot of people argue is not, you know, if you go back to sort of the 70s and 80s, 60s, all the national, how inefficient they were, you wouldn't go back there anyway. But then the way he's going to do it, he has no idea how it works. And I just find that astonishing. Do you, that level of lack of detail, you know?
Absolutely. No, well, it doesn't surprise me at a certain level, but there you go. It's this is the magic money tree, isn't it? And the magic money tree not only provides all the finance, it does all the sort of the boring sort of explanatory and fiddly stuff for you, if only that could be true.
Yeah. Okay, let's look at some individual companies, bigger market caps than I normally look at, and you're my eyes and ears across that world. Anyone with news out, Chris?
Well, it's got to be. We've got to start with DS Smith, which is always a boring name. The ticker's SMDS. But every time you receive an Amazon parcel or other e-commerce providers, have you ever thought who's the company providing the corrugated board that you probably get too much of when you do get a parcel? But it's not just on e-commerce. Actually, DS Smith, one of the biggest providers to also the fast-moving consumer goods companies. So all of the, whenever you see, I don't know, some sweet packaging or some other consumer good packaging, often they're a big provider there too. Their half-year numbers showed continued progress on all fronts. I'm slightly surprised to see the shares down today, because what I'm seeing myself is that actually this is a British company making a bit of progress in some interesting kind of growth areas, bedding down acquisitions they're making in places such as Spain and Romania, expanding across Europe and the States too. Actually seem to be a quite sensible company, paying a bit more in dividend, not particularly expensive. Shares have done okay year to date, but I think there's more to come. Slightly surprised by the reaction today.
Yeah, it's down, like I say, 2.2%. But yeah, all the metrics, you know, I mean, you get revenue up by, 4%, adjusted profit up by 15%, profit before tax up by 31%. It's all looking good, and yet it's down. Maybe this was, I mean, I thought, I'll go to the chart, maybe this was priced in, maybe they've had a strong rise of late. They haven't had that strong a rise. It's been, you know, since 2019, they've been in a range pretty much between, I'd say, 380 and 320, and it went to the top of 380, now it's back down to 370 today. So it's in that range. It hasn't broken out or anything, but
decent figures,
aren't they, I suppose?
Yeah, no, I think it looks okay. And potentially, you know, if you think about it, is it very, very export-centric? Could a rise in the pound, you know, hurt it? Actually, not particularly, I don't think, because I think what they might lose a little bit on exports, and of course many of their operations actually are based overseas, so, you know, it's not as if you're exporting a huge amount. You'll, I think, gain potentially on a more optimistic UK stroke global economy or something. So, yeah, I think this is a play looking forward into next year. Even if you do get a Brexit deal, a bit more clarity on that, you'd have thought it's that kind of sort of industrial consumer sort of thing which kind of would benefit from that. So, for me, looks interesting here. Hoping to see a fall on the share price sooner rather than later.
Yeah, well, do you know what? And Amazon, it's so addictive. I find it really, the ease of shopping on Amazon is hard to resist. You know, just go on, just click, done. It's there within a day or 2 days on Prime. I got Prime, you know, and I think, and I can't see, since I've had Amazon, I've become a bigger shopper on Amazon. And almost every month, I think I'm buying more rubbish for that. And I've got to stop it, especially Christmas time now. To be honest, I think it's because Christmas. I've had it very easy to do. At least, you know, a couple of years ago, I may have ventured out to buy something. Now, why? And I can't see Amazon's appeal, you know, diminishing. I mean, I know global concerns about buying stuff and all that, and anti-consumerism is there. But I can't see it for a long time diminishing this appeal. So I think they're going to, you know, they'll be supplying more and more cardboard boxes or corrugated cardboard for a long time to come. I just can't see this market, you know, diminishing at all. It's very buoyant.
I think that's absolutely right. And also some of the differentiations, I can't believe, like DS Smith gives to the consumer names, you know, individual packaging and things like that, things which, know, they want in order to differentiate their product. But I tell you though, if I would definitely agree on the retail world, you know, clearly we've got some structural shifts going on here. What was it? Clinton Cards announced in the last 24 hours for the second time in 6 or 7 years they've got bailed out, etc. You know, when a Christmas card or when a card company is having problems just before Christmas, you know, what happens in the world after Christmas when we certainly don't be, you know, we're not sending cards in January or something like that, are we? So, you know, all sorts of issues there. But you look at some of the other numbers out today. Look at Dunelm. Dunelm, again, you know, Dunelm's one of these funny businesses. They've only just started advertising on TV, but all those sort of soft furnishings and other stuff that they do for the home, they've got a good little niche there, very high market share in some of the areas that they're strong in. And as a consequence, they've announced this morning that profits will be slightly ahead of expectations. Shares have zoomed up again, you know, deep into the £9 and change level. So, you know, there are pockets of kind of retailers doing a reasonable job. Jewels also came out with a little statement today. They're a bit smaller. They're on the AIM market. But Jewels, again, it had a good tone to the statement, I thought, today. And so, you know, there are retailers who are actually doing a reasonable job. But I must admit, I don't own either of those shares. We talked about Dunelm before. I did trade that one.
I didn't expect it to be as well as it has. But yeah, it's almost as ones where you just, you shouldn't tar every, you know, retail brand with the same brush, saying that, oh, they're all against it. Well, maybe they are, but like I said, there are going to be some who are decent businesses, decent brands that will win out. And like I said, Jules is very recognisable, and Dunelm. And when I saw that, I thought, wow, they had a bit of a turnaround story going on, and it seems to be working out. So there are, like, I agree with you, there are pockets there. You've got to be very selective because, you know, the retail sector is hard work at the moment. But like I said, there are some winning out, aren't there, you know?
That's right. That's right. Now, I mean, moving on to financials, it's the same, really, isn't it? We sort of, everyone thinks all financials are terrible, and there are some big banks that there are, I would say, which are quite good value still. Things like Lloyds. I would even push that into a Barclays or an RBS. I could make those shares work. What I still can't make work, and I see there's been an announcement on it over the last 24 hours, is Metro Bank, which, you know, you and I have talked about before. The shares have been all over the place, generally down, heavily down over the last year or two. But the company announced late yesterday that the CEO, who's been there for a good while, a good decade, is leaving the company. Although he will be an advisor to the company for the next year, one of those sort of strange things that happen. But he's leaving. They're going to appoint somebody else. They haven't announced who yet. But it is the big revolving door at Metro Bank. Obviously, the founder chairman, Vernon Hill, got effectively the boot in the last few months as well. He's kind of leaving the two. So as the sort of the shocker, their problematic strategy, compliance issues, all sorts of things going on, is starting to continue to unwind. People are still jumping off the sinking ship, and they're trying to, you know, appoint basically a completely new board in order to try to steer this one in the 2020s. But I have to say, I do wonder whether the end result for Metro Bank is that it's just absorbed into something a bit bigger, somebody who wants maybe their exposure to mortgages and banking products and savings and whatever, but actually will help sort out some of the bigger issues that seem to be at work there in terms of compliance and culture and other stuff.
Yeah, well, listen, they're starting to lose money now, aren't they? I mean, and you've got, like I said, it's a business that's not working out because they've got so much debt now and bonds, and they have to pay off these interests. I think it's next year when the next one kicks in, they'll be paying $80 million. In interest on these bonds alone. Now, they didn't even make half of that in their best year, and they're way below that now. So it's odd to see what's going to happen here. It seems like the challenger banks, I've said this, are challenged by how much, you know, liquidity and capital they have to hold. And it's hard for them, at their size, their scale, you know, it's hard for them to do this. They're challenged by the legislation for a bank. And I only see the only way out here for this bank is to be taken over by a bigger bank, surely. And that's not what was in mind when the FCA said, we need to challenge a bank. So it goes against it. It's odd. They're trapped in this, you know, the legislative sort of jail, and they can't get out unless a bigger bank comes along and snaps them up. But when will that happen? Like we said before, if this deteriorates, you know, if you're a big bank, why rush in? You know, the share price is going to, if the business is going to get worse, wait, sit on the sidelines. You know, if you want a part of it, you're all the time in the world. You can maybe pick it up for half the price, you know? So it's not getting any better.
And also, yeah, you may say, look, you just want to buy the book of loans or the consumer base, or you might find that actually the consumer base comes to you, because often that's the case with banks. If there's a few fears, we've seen it a little bit in Metro Bank already, that some of the bigger corporate customers have moved. They were a bit worried about the balance sheet, some of the disclosures in recent months, and so they've moved. So banks are funny beasts. You know, you sometimes think you've got a business, but actually, of course, it's a business based on trust and hope, and suddenly sometimes that can just whittle away without you thinking about it too much. And yeah, I have to say, Metro Bank shares, good luck. I mean, I can certainly see it being taken over, but you're quite right to say at what price is a very, very moot point. And there's no guarantee that this is a classic takeover, if it even happens at a premium to prevailing share prices. Things move quick, and accountancy is opaque and everything else within the financial sector.
Yeah, well, I mean, the bank that's... that's going to take them over, maybe, we'll be looking at them saying, well, listen, you know, we can push a hard bargain here because we're in no rush, and they are in a rush. They need a rescuing, full stop. And they've still got the FCA, I think, complaint hanging over them anyway. No one knows what's going to happen with that, whether it's going to be a fine or not. But, I mean, I think they're saying, I read somewhere, that the next CEO will not be coming in until that's out of the way. So, because he doesn't want to come in and get a rap over the knuckles and get that on his record, the FCA have given him telling off. So, you know, that's going to come up with... So many unknowns in my mind, you know, and I'd prefer to get some of them out of the way, you know, before... I even consider having a punch here, because that is just grinding the
precisely.
Load.
Precisely.
You know. Marvellous stuff. Yeah.
Right.
Anything else, Chris, happening?
Well, quick final one on Amigo. We talked about Amigo, I think, last week.
Yeah.
You know, the sort of the expensive lender that obviously tries to use sort of family and friends to help you to back up, you know, the loan that they're making to you. Obviously, there's been a variety of issues and shockers here. I see that they punched out an announcement this morning saying that they are now compliant with the minimum free float requirement by the FCA of 25%. They've now got a free float of 28%. That's only because some of the management team sold some of their shares. They called it tax planning and everything else at the time. But it seems the reality is that it's all because they needed to raise the free float a bit. So, again, just tells you this is a poorly managed company. I mean, personally, I have quite a few moral issues with the operations, but in terms of the sort of the operational management of the company, you know, this is the sort of the ABC sort of things to do. You know, watch your minimum free float, be adherent on that. Otherwise, why on earth are you listing? You know, their corporate advisors should have told them about that. The fact that they've had to, you know, months and months and months after they floated, they're finally having to fiddle that and sell shares in order to qualify and, you know, make sure they're within the rules on that, is just another sign that this is not a well-run company doing some very weird and bizarre things. I see the shares have remained flat on their back after the big fall last week, and quite rightly so.
Yeah, yeah. It is that thing, is that when you're investing, you can always make an ethical decision, you know. And like I say, let's be honest, their customers are people who are struggling, and you know, pretty much. And so you think, do you want to be involved in that kind of business? You know, I particularly don't. Is there opportunities out there, you know? So there we are. Marvellous, Chris, thanks for that, and we'll speak to you next week.
Sounds good. See you then. Election day next week. My goodness, it's all exciting times.
Yes, absolutely. All I'm just hoping for is we don't get a hung parliament. I don't want another year of arguing in the House of Commons, you know, about Brexit,
right,
which way we go. And you know, I did vote to leave. At the moment, though, do you know what? I don't care anymore. I just want something to happen to move it along
just
some way.
Yeah,
I just want as long as we get from this impasse of just being stuck in the middle, because that's the damage being done right there, not knowing where we're going. And that's why people are sitting on the sidelines, not investing. And I think we have to move it on some way, you know. And a hung parliament will not do that. So that's what I'm worried about. Marvellous, Chris. Thanks for that. Speak next week.
We'll see. No problems. See them. Yeah, bye.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Glenn Goodman, the crypto trader is the name of his book. And are you called the crypto trader on Twitter, or do you call Glenn?
I'm just called Glenn Goodman, you know.
Yeah, okay.
I stick to Glenn Goodman.
Yeah. All right.
I like that.
Third rule in your book here, right? It says, trade the trend. Yes, exactly. In fact, I'm not a trader, I'm an investor. But the trend here, that's why I'm out of Bitcoin. You know, it's just see it as a downtrend at the moment. Until I
that's
see
why I'm out of Bitcoin,
yeah,
too.
Until I see a convincing turn up trend, and I'm not in it. Because I understand it has the ability to rally impressively, and you can get some gains off it, some decent gains. But at the moment, it's just got that downward pressure, isn't it? All the way. It's rallying. And like I said before, it's rallying like it's a bear market. You know, it's very erratic rallies. We're not seeing... in an uptrend sometimes, at least you see a general, you know, climb, higher lows, series of higher lows, but this is just all over the place. It's like someone, if it was, you know, replicating teeth, then it'd be someone's teeth have been knocked out with the dynamite. They're brushing their teeth with dynamite toothpaste, you know, because it's just all over the place. It's a really ugly looking chart, you know.
I know, and as a trader myself, I've found it quite frustrating, particularly in recent, last couple of weeks in particular, have been quite frustrating because, you know, traders look out for certain kinds of patterns in the charts. Those are the patterns that we trade off. And obviously the big pattern, the one that we keep talking about on this podcast, is the big long channel that has been forming since July now, where, you know, because Bitcoin quadrupled in price. Just a quick reminder for anybody who we haven't already told, the price quadrupled from sort of March onwards, you know, a massive rise in Bitcoin, and then it's just been heading downwards in this kind of pipe shape, this channel, ever since. So that's since July, and as you say, while it's in this downtrend, it's not really something that sort of screams invest in me right now. You need some kind of sign as to where the direction is going to go in the longer term. Now, we assume that that direction will be up, but we want to see some sign that the price is going to break through the top of that channel. And meantime, as I say, it's been frustrating. The last few weeks, we've seen some really good potential entries. I've entered Bitcoin a couple of times, only to then have to exit again with either a small profit or a small loss, because I'm the kind of trader who manages my risk very carefully. I always make sure I never make a large loss, only at worst a small loss, or preferably a small profit if a trade doesn't work out the way I expected. And yesterday, I'm talking about Wednesday, was a crazy day because the price shot up in the morning by 8%. Mm-hmm. You know, which if that was a stock, you'd be like, 8%, there must be a really significant reason for this. This is, you know, a significant move. But no, in Bitcoin, it meant absolutely nothing. The price shot up by 8%. And then by the end of the day, it had shot all the way back down again. Yeah. And so, you know, I was sitting by my computer quite a lot of yesterday, sort of thinking, well, up 8%, you know, this could be the beginning of the big one. And the number of false alarms I've had like that in recent weeks is just annoying. Yeah. It's nothing more than that.
And do you know what? The volatility of Bitcoin, that kind of volatility, is the very thing, right, that will dispel any promise or any hope of it becoming a safe asset store of value. Because when it's that volatile, you can't store. You can't even exchange with it, really. You can't. And that's the worry. It's this volatility where people don't like. As I said, at least with gold, yes, it can be a little bit volatile. Nowhere near as volatile as Bitcoin. But, you know, it's you know, like I said, if you look at gold, like for a long time, just traded in a range for a long time, then it broke up. It never really trades. You never see it doing like 8% in an hour, or like or something ridiculous, and then shooting back down 8% now. So, you know, people will not use Bitcoin as digital gold if it doesn't stabilize. And I don't know if it is going to stabilize. You know, I don't know where it gets to the point where, I suppose, if supply comes down, will it stabilize or will it get worse?
Well, the low volumes are clearly to blame at the moment for the erratic price rises and falls, because historically, you know, we're not anymore in what was called the crypto winter, which was from January to March this year, when crypto, you know, the price of Bitcoin was approximately half of what it is now, and everybody had kind of given up on it. Now, we're not quite in that phase, but nonetheless, volumes are very, very low at the moment, and things are very quiet. And when volumes are that low, all it takes is one so-called whale, as they call them,
problem,
in the Bitcoin community, to shove that price right up, and then another whale to shove it back down again. As that is the problem, but of course, it's kind of a vicious circle, isn't it? Because if you say, well, low volumes, like low amount of trading, not many people interested, is causing the price to be volatile, which then causes people not to want to adopt it as a currency, then that's a vicious circle. We need to get back into the virtuous circle that we had during the previous bull market.
Yeah, well, it's not a safe store of value, because the value keeps going up and down. It's not safe at all. The value goes down, and so it's not. And like I said, when you have, you know, massive influence from one or two big, or you know, a dozen, or I suppose, no, it's about 100, I think, big holders, massive holders. When they can actually move the price like that, it's a bit worrying. I mean, in stocks and shares, I think with the FCA, not a lot, there's got to be a certain amount of free float. I mean, you know, you've got to have free float. And there's obviously lots of liquidity and lots of shareholders. So one person can't have that kind of influence. And that's the problem. That's what's going to spoil.
Well, it can in small stocks, though. I mean, you must have seen loads
of small
stocks.
Yeah, you can.
I mean, I've moved small stocks just with my with my relatively small purchases. You know, I'll buy a small stock and then the price shoots up and I feel powerful.
In fact, I look for that as well, as one of the things. I look for, you know, if I'm looking at small cap stocks, that ticks a lot of my boxes, you know, sort of tech, the scalable, undervalued pretty much, so they've got cash and the skin in the game by the way. I always look at the shareholder register. It's very important, and not only see if the management have skin in the game, but how much free float is there? Because if there's lack of free float, then it doesn't take a lot to move it, you know? And I look at that, yeah. But do you know what also? Do you know this guy called Plan B? Is it Plan B on Twitter? He got the stock-to-flow model.
Oh, yes, yeah. I've been studying that model just by coincidence this week. I didn't realise you were also familiar with it.
Oh, yeah, I did about the video, but I'm questioning it now. And the fact is, he's ignoring my questions. I've asked him about 5 times. Right? Now, this is based on gold stock-to-flow ratio is about 72. This means the stock that's out there at the moment, for people who don't know, and then the flow that comes online. So gold, like I said, there's a lot of gold now, you know, in stock. It's held very tightly, pretty much, and there's not a lot coming online. So silver is about, is it 26 or 27 or something? I think Bitcoin's in the middle, but its stock to flow ratio will go up towards gold, obviously the less comes into supply of Bitcoin. But I argued this, and I argued
so. So the idea is that, yeah, that the price goes up because, just for people who don't understand it, that the price tends to go up if you get a lot of new. Yeah, if you get a kind of constriction of flow of new gold being mined, or new Bitcoin being mined, or whatever it is, compared to the amount that already exists.
Yeah, because of course, you know, less supply. You know, even if you have a static demand, pretty much, the price should go up. But now, if you have a creeping demand, even a little bit of demand, and the supply is going down, then obviously it'll move the price up. But this is what I've argued, and someone argued with me. In fact, I'll try and find it on my thing, but and a couple of times, I think probably not 5, but 3 times, because he sees the price after halving going towards, I think it's like $25,000 this year, and then $100,000 by the end of next year, maybe, or something like that. So $100,000 per Bitcoin, that's how you see it. And it's very technical, and he's gone into it, you know, almost blinds you with science. And I often worry about that. I can't understand half of it, but I understand stock to flow, but he goes into a lot of depth on it. So it almost convinces you this guy knows what to do. So I've asked him a couple of times. I said, this is where it differs, though, fella. And can you, you know, I said, will the stock to flow model of Bitcoin be affected by the elasticity of stock? And what I mean by that is, with gold, it's very inelastic. Half of the gold out there, the stock, is held in jewellery. Now, it's not that easy to sell that straight away. It's not that liquid. Most people have them as sentimental value. They don't even care at the price of it. It's on their fingers. So that stock is not going to, that supply is not going to come onto the market very quickly. A lot of it's held by central banks. Again, another 20%. So 60% of gold stock is pretty much, it's going to stay there. It's not going to go back onto the market. It's not going to flood the market. Now, I argue with Bitcoin, it's so easy to sell. So if you're a holder, you can click a button, literally sell some straight away. You know, so if the price starts going down, you can sell. That's why the volatility is there. And I said, that would
surely. And there are many billions of dollars worth of it sitting in accounts that haven't been touched for donkey's years. And, you know, because obviously everything's transparent on the blockchain, so you can see the billions of dollars worth of Bitcoin sitting there, and but you don't know who actually owns it. And the fact that it's never moved, a lot of it, like, you know, a very large proportion, in fact, of the total stock of Bitcoin has just never moved, or very rarely moved, not moved in years. And so the question then becomes, is it that a big whale is waiting for their moment to sell, or did it belong to, say, Satoshi Nakamoto, the creator of Bitcoin, who mysteriously disappeared? You know, maybe nobody, you know, the person who owns all those billions has died, say, and it's just going to sit there forever because nobody knows the key to get into that Bitcoin account.
Yeah. So all I argue is that the stock of Bitcoin is a lot more elastic. It's a lot more liquid. You know, it can be, it can be converted to cash a lot faster than gold can. People, you know, the people who weigh gold, half the gold out there is worn as jewelry. You know, people don't care about the price of it. They just, it's an ornament. They hold it. It's a ring. They don't want to sell it because the price of gold goes down. People will sell Bitcoin because the price goes down. I was worried about
true.
That.
So I guess central banks can suddenly make huge purchases or sales, and do make huge purchases or sales of gold. Well, like Gordon Brown did, remember, infamously at the beginning of this century when he sold off all our gold far too cheaply.
Yeah. So I question his model there, and he doesn't. He's three times I've asked him that, and he's ignored me. And I'm saying, do you know what, mate? You're conveniently ignoring me. I know you'll probably say, oh, I've got lots of followers. Not that many, you know. I mean, he's got enough to see. I can see he replies to people who compliment his stock to flow model.
Right.
But he hasn't got time to reply to me when I question its validity.
Well, I might be able to help you with that because, as I say, by sheer coincidence, I've been studying this exact model this week. I mean, I was already familiar with it, but I decided to kind of really try and work out, as you are trying to work out, whether it has true validity. But the maths goes beyond my kind of A-level maths. It goes even, you know, I did A-level maths, but it goes beyond that. So I've been consulting a specialist, a statistician who teaches at universities, a collaborator of mine, and I've asked him to take a close look at the model and tell me whether he thinks it has true validity or whether there are little holes in it that I haven't.
Put that to him, because if you base it on good, like gold, I mean, the stock is going to be as held as tightly as gold. Fair enough, but Bitcoin is not. People trade it all the time. People trade it very, very quickly, and literally you can turn into cash within a split second. You know, under a second. So, like I said, and most of the stock of gold will not be traded or sold because it's as jewelry. So it's very, you know, it's very tightly held, basically. So asking that, put that input. Say, listen, he's comparing it to gold exactly, but it's not similar to gold. It's a very different. So I'm questioning.
Well, hopefully, I'll be able to report back with next week on the podcast with an answer to all of that. Actually, one interesting point he said after I emailed him, he had a quick look through the model. He said, I'll have a proper look at it later. But his initial thought was that when Bitcoin stops being mined, you know, when all of it has been mined, okay, that's not for a century or more before that happens. But he said, once it happens, of course, flow will go to zero. Whereas stock will be, you know, in other words, the model would predict that the price of Bitcoin will reach infinity at the point that the flow becomes zero, which obviously is impossible. Yeah. So that's already a kind of theoretical problem with the model. But we'll have to wait and see whether, practically speaking, he thinks it would work or wouldn't work.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, well, people trade it, don't they, freely, easily, they don't even touch it with, you know, gold. People actually, you know, some people touch gold and they have it on their homes, but people don't even touch Bitcoin, they just trade it back and forth. It's a lot more liquid. Any news out this week in crypto?
Yeah, there's a few stories I will make you aware of. Idiot of the week, let's start with him. A guy called Virgil Griffith. Have you come across this guy? Virgil Griffith is a 36-year-old cryptocurrency developer who has been arrested in America for giving a talk in North Korea to North Koreans on allegedly on how to launder money using cryptocurrency. So basically, he was arrested a few days ago at Los Angeles International Airport. He's an American who lives in Singapore. They think he might have been traveling back to America for the Thanksgiving break. And he was arrested because of a trip that he made to North Korea in April of this year. And so what basically happened is he decided, he's been in the cryptocurrency community and quite active in it for many years and is sort of respected as a programmer. In fact, he's he first gained notoriety a long time ago, almost 20 years ago, about 15 years ago, he created a thing called Wikiscanner, which was a useful little tool that allowed people to find out which companies had been trying to anonymously edit their Wikipedia entries, so that you could see which companies were trying to sort of manipulate the official encyclopedia record about their own company. So, you know, he's done good things in the past. He's got a PhD in computation and neural systems. He moved to Silicon Valley. He's been working for Ethereum, one of the top cryptocurrencies. And then he decided it would be cool, I think those were his exact words, it would be cool to go to North Korea and speak at a conference, the Pyongyang Blockchain and Cryptocurrency Conference, where he described, because he was asked to, how blockchain and crypto technology could be used by the government of North Korea to launder money, and which obviously is against the law in America, because it kind of violates, allegedly violates sanctions.
But he is simple, isn't he? He must just go in there, think he's just, you know, educating and all that stuff. And it basically, just it's just saying to your enemy, yeah, here's all our secret, top secret files. Have a look through them. See if you like the font and all that stuff, you know. You know, anything of interest in there, you know, by all means use it if you want to. And you realise, oh, hang on, they're an enemy, really, aren't they? I shouldn't have done that. Yeah.
But he thought it would be cool. Yeah. What are you going to do? He now faces up to 20 years in prison, which is not quite so cool, I'm thinking.
Maybe he should go on a course of how to escape prison or someone else, because that's what he's going to need. I got to laugh, it happened on Thanksgiving. I mean, he's not thankful for that at all, is he? Right, lovely.
But I would say that it's interesting. One interesting thing about it is that it kind of fits in with what we were talking last week about central bank digital currencies. You know how the European Central Bank, the Chinese Central Bank, and Mark Carney himself, they've all been making plans for a central bank digital currency, the aim of which, even for the Europeans, is to try and circumvent US dollar power, the fact that the US controls almost the entire world's trading system. I mean, when I say trade, I mean exports and imports, because most trade is done in dollars, and therefore everybody has to use the US banking system. This annoys everybody. This annoys the Europeans. It annoys Mark Carney. It annoys the Chinese. So everybody's trying to create their own central bank digital currencies because they think this will be a way to circumvent the entire legacy infrastructure of the traditional banking system and just kind of create a new furrow whereby they can trade around the world. And so effectively, that's what this guy is accused of advising North Korea about. Well, when we say money laundering, we basically mean allowing them to trade with other countries who are prepared to trade with them while circumventing the sanctions against them by circumventing the dollar. So that kind of all goes to show that central bank digital currencies, as well as any kind of digital currency like Bitcoin, all of these are a major threat to the dollar and to America's power in the world.
Yeah. But oddly, did you see this week that Japan said they have no need of digital currency? I don't know, which is a bit odd to say. Why would you be that short-sighted there? You know, why didn't you keep your options open there? I never understand that, even with politicians. Like, when you see someone like, you know, Boris Johnson saying, if you don't get Brexit done, you know, by this time, I'll die in a ditch, I'll be prepared. Don't put a hard stop on it. You really are boxing yourself into a corner. Like the Japanese, we have no need of a digital currency. Do you know what? You're using digital currencies pretty much, because every transaction you make pretty much online these days is digital. So that's a ridiculous thing to say,
isn't
it?
It's all electronic. Yeah, that's the distinction that we make, is between electronic transactions, which is everything, you know, every time we swipe a card, and digital currency, which is a slightly different concept, but very easy to get confused between the two, because they're quite similar, as you say.
They're the same. It's digital. It's binary. It's zero, zeros, and ones.
Yeah, bits and bytes.
So it's all digital. You know, it's not like physical, is it? So how they say it, we don't have no need. I mean, that's someone in charge of central bank saying we have no need of digital currencies, or what are you talking about? Get out. He must be, I bet he's about 112. He's probably one of the oldest men. Normally they are, the Japanese, they hold that record, don't they? A lot, oldest men in the world records. So he's probably his hundreds, thinking, no, we have no need of digital currency. I don't know why he'd have that accent, because he's Japanese.
They translate that into a Japanese accent, and he'd sound exactly like that. Yeah. But it's ironic, because Japan is traditionally one of the most encouraging of cryptocurrencies, or it has been in the past. You know, they've had nice relaxed rules that allowed companies to kind of set up there and experiment with different cryptocurrency structures and that kind of thing. You know, Japan was always seen as a kind of open door for that kind of thing. But this is that's what's interesting about all the countries around, all the major countries, is that they all blow hot and cold the whole time. Like we've seen with China, on one hand it's going, oh, we're going gung-ho for cryptocurrency, and on the other hand it's there were rumors that it was that they were raiding the offices of cryptocurrency companies, of Bitcoin companies, just last week, for example. So, you know, all these countries blow hot and cold because they can't decide how to feel about it. Because on one hand, they're thinking, oh, there could be all kinds of advantages and we could possibly beat the dollar and beat America and blah, blah, blah. But on the other hand, they're thinking this stuff could undermine our power as well, which, of course, it could. If the likes of Bitcoin and Ethereum prevail, then the European Central Bank would effectively become less powerful. So would the British Central Bank. So, you know, the Bank of England. So, you know, the Bank of England. So yeah. Would the Federal Reserve. Because monetary policy obviously depends on control over money. And your interest rate levers will be less effective if everybody's transacting in, say, Bitcoin or Ethereum.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm hoping Bitcoin will go down to about $1,000 again.
Really?
I'm hoping.
Why do you think that?
I don't think it will. I'm hoping it will, so I can just pick up a bit of Bitcoin, just a nice round figure. I think
you're hoping.
I don't know. Do you know what? At the moment, there's a line in the sand here. Here we are. You can record this. Well, I'm recording it, but at the moment, where we're sitting now, to 7,000, I could see it forming a base here and trading sideways for a while, and building from this level. And if it doesn't go sideways, if it just keeps going up and down like crazy again, it'll probably sell off again. People, you know, don't like the volatility there. But if it trades sideways...
it's just in quite a defined channel, though, don't you think?
Yeah. I mean,
it's really quite defined now. It's been going on for, you know, as we've said, since July. And so there have been enough ups and downs in it for us to draw some nice kind of lines at the top and the bottom of it.
Yeah.
And as far as I'm concerned, I mean, I can see what you're saying, that possibly there's a short-term base building here, but... it's only a possibility. More likely than not, we're just going to carry on oscillating within this channel until we don't one day, I guess.
I'd like to see it form this base, you know, for a while, just 7,000, you know, as a hard base. 6,500 it dipped to recently, but it popped back up to 7,000. If you can keep along that for a while and let the 200-day moving average just come in over, I know, and catch up with it a little bit, and then break above that, that'd be quite nice. But otherwise 6,000. Otherwise, 3,000.
3,000?
Yeah.
Oh, do we have to go back down there again, Justin?
No, it'd take too long, I think, wouldn't it? I don't know. Who knows? But the thing with Bitcoin is the more it falls...
Bitcoin is who knows.
Yeah. The more it falls, the less people have faith in it. So the more people sell, you know?
And then but that's a good thing, because, of course, it shakes out the so-called weak hands, and then you're just left with the strong buyers, the holders, the people who've been in it
deluded
for years. And new buyers come in. You know, once all the weak sellers, the people who are like, shall I sell,
But do you know what, though?
It can rise more easily.
Yeah, I know, but those people who are just holding are deluded. Because, you know, you can save yourself some money, and just say, okay, listen, if it's going to go down... rebuy it when it's lower down. If it's going to go up,
well, tell me about it. That's what my entire book's about.
Yeah, I know, but it's like when it broke down for that certain level, that 8,000 level, I thought, no, listen, that's it. I mean, to me, that's broken down again now. I was hoping it would hold 8,000. Now I'm hoping it would hold 7,000, but I don't hold any Bitcoin anymore. So I'm just going, okay, I'm just going to wait. I'm just going to wait until that moving average is...
no hurry.
Look at the moving averages, right? They're all curving over. When I said the last thing that happened, when the 200-day crossed that 125 last time, last twice that happened, it hasn't been good for the price. It's literally grinded lower and lower and lower. It's had a couple of rallies, of course it does, but I mean, generally, it didn't go above the 200-day moving average again for months. And so, you know, we may see this time next year, we're still below that 200-day moving average. So there we are.
Well, unless I see a really nice base of the kind that you're talking about form, which would possibly provide a good buying point. If that doesn't happen, I'll be waiting for the price to break up through the top of this big channel, because when that happens, you know, and that means, of course, I'll miss out on the first part of the gains. As I can't remember which trading genius it was. Was it Jesse Livermore who said that the first, yes, it was him, I think, who said the first eighth, the bottom eighth and the top eighth of a trend are the most expensive eighths in the market, because trying to pick those tops and bottoms, it will cost you every time, because you get it wrong and you'll get it wrong and you keep getting in and out and in and out and your money drains away. Far more sensible is to wait until you've seen the trend begin to turn. And in the case of Bitcoin, that would mean breaking up through the top of this channel, which would mean the price would have to rise about $1,000-$1,500 from where it is now. So I'd miss out on that bottom $1,000-$1,500 of profit, but at least I'd have the surety that the price had broken up through the top of the channel, which would be a really good technical sign that we were on the up. And hopefully then the price would rise and rise at least to its previous high, which was $14,000 back in July or back in June, and then possibly breach its all-time high at $20,000 from there. That's what technical analysis would tell us is likely to happen. Obviously, there are no assurances in this game. It's all educated guesswork, but nonetheless, that traditionally would be how charts operate.
Okay.
You hear me?
Okay, Glenda, I hear you loud and clear coming through like a crypto trader man. Yes, all right. Listen, thanks for that, and we'll do some more chatting on Bitcoin, crypto, and blockchain next weeky. Speaking next weeky.
Look forward to it.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. At five, Defence PLC, that's DFX ticker. At four, MNC Saatchi, really, SAA ticker there, down 2.66% to 76.9 pence. What's Defence? No mover. Non-mover, 2.75 pence. Firestone Diamonds, down 15% at 0.975 pence. At two, Tissue Regenics, or Regenics, up 27.5% at 1.275 pence. And number one most followed company, Richland Resources, RLD, is ticker there, up 23.33%. Okay, top five most liked RNSs are as follows. At five, Ark Minerals, major exploration development at Chiesa East. I've never said that right. At four, Innova Derma, DTC channel, delivers best Black Friday weekend. At three, Optibiotics Health, Slim Biome Medical Update. At two, Cora Gold, maiden resource at Sanankoro. And number one, most liked RNS, most read, Drilling and Metallurgical Update, the Toral Project for Europa Metals. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos apreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.